as a species, we should understand that progress happens in clusters. And if we want progress, we should be studying these clusters and trying to recreate them as much as possible.
This is Audience of One, and I'm your host, Spencer Keir. This podcast is a venue and excuse for me to explore my curiosity through Combo's leading thinkers and builders. My guest today is Vizakan Veerasamy, aka Viza on Twitter. On top of being prolific on Twitter, he's also written two books, Friendly Ambitious Nerds and Introspect, both of which I highly recommend. Viza and I talk about writing, network scenes and subcultures, deviance and outliers, being introspective, and much, much more. Please enjoy.
How do I start? Hi, I'm Visa. I'm Singaporean. I'm 32. I grew up as a library nerd. I love reading. And then when I discovered the internet, to me, the internet was like a library that I could write and participate in. And I've just always been very literary, very online, very eager to participate in and contribute to just language and culture. And you know, I love magazines and I loved music. I used to play in a band. And when I was playing in a band, I was very much a part of like my local music scene, which in like 2007-ish, this is kind of like the MySpace era. And we had like internet forums and stuff. And I was very invested in trying to understand how we could use online forums to facilitate interesting conversations. And I was just always, I was swept up in that stuff. I loved it. When it was bad, it made me upset, like witnessing people have like fights and internet drama, flame wars and all those things. And I always thought it was so unnecessary. I always felt that people did not sufficiently appreciate community online or in real life as well. And so I've always been very passionate about trying to, and you know, I feel like I grew up in those spaces and like I found myself in those spaces. And so I feel a strong sense of communion with those spaces and like the internet as a whole. You know, I sometimes joke that like the internet is like my mom, you know, like the internet is my family. And so I still believe very strongly that we have not even begun to like tap into the potential of the internet and each other through the internet and it's just people in general. So even if there was no internet, I would be like ranting about books probably and literature and the opportunity for people to connect and commune and magazines and all those things. So I used to work in software marketing. Sometimes people are curious about like my career. I started blogging from a very young age, and that got me some local attention about local news and stuff. And my ex-boss, he found me through my blog. He headhunted me, I guess, to run marketing for a software company, which was great. I learned about e-commerce and referral marketing, social media marketing, all those things. And it was great. I learned a lot. And even when I was playing in a band, I guess I was always very conscious of marketing and how to get your message out, how to communicate to people, how to build a brand, how to make friends, create spaces, blah, blah, blah. And so I had a great time with my job and my colleagues and everything, but I always felt like, and I want to be a writer. You know, I want to do more creative stuff, do my own thing. So I left my job in 2018. I was 28, and I wanted to just do creative writing on every front simultaneously, just to see what happened. And my Twitter blew up, particularly. Like I grew from like a couple of thousand followers to like 10,000, 20,000. Now I have like 50,000 followers. And I think what people enjoy about my Twitter is that I am very... So, you know, my first book is titled Friendly Ambitious Nerd. And I basically wrote it by asking people... Because people would ask me all the time, like, we love your tweets. Do you have a book? I would love to buy your book. And I'm like, what should I write a book about? You know? And so I'd ask people, how do you introduce me to other people when you share my tweets and stuff? And they would say things like, oh, you know, you're very friendly. You share all these like pro-social, how to be a good friend, how to give compliments, how to, all those things. And then they would also say, you're so prolific. You tweet so much. You seem to have all these like lofty goals and ambitions. And then they would say, you're so curious. You do all these exploratory, nerdy, kind of librarian, curious trivia stuff, geek stuff. And so, yeah, those were the things that people recommended about me to other people, which is what I'm known for on Twitter. It's also the title of my first book, Friendly Ambitious Nerd. And so, yeah, I guess I am like this tweeter, YouTuber sort of, you know, blogger, creative. Like, I sometimes describe myself as like an internet busker. Again, like, I guess because of my music background, like, I have this performance aspect to it. And I'm always passionate about community. And yeah, it's kind of a long ass rambly rant, but that's more or less everything.
No, that's exactly what I was looking for. And there's a lot there to touch on. The first thing that comes to mind is you had mentioned towards the middle of that, you've always been fascinated by online communities, forums, the internet was your mom of sorts. And you had said you don't think we've even begun to scratch the surface of what the potential is here.
Yeah.
Is it is that an infrastructure problem? Is it a cultural problem, a mix of? And okay. What do we need to improve culture-wise?
Well, okay. So how I tend to describe this is that people tend to come to media with the intuitions that they've inherited. And so we have not yet even begun really perceiving the internet and social media as what it is capable of. We come to it with like broadcast media intuitions from like television and radio from like decades and decades ago. Mm-hmm. And one of the ways I explain this is like, think about the electric guitar, for example. So the electric guitar was invented in the 1940s. And when that happened, people saw it as, oh, it's like a guitar, but it's louder. And so we're just going to play it the same way. And it took like Jimi Hendrix to show up in the 1970s. To show people that, oh wow, you can do all these weird alien sounds with it, you can put effects on it, you can, you know, use the mics and the feedbacks and the speakers, and it's a whole different instrument. And theoretically, you could have had Jimi Hendrix in the 1940s, but it took 30 years for Hendrix to show up, because it took 30 years for people to not approach the electric guitar with, oh, it's a guitar but louder, you know, with the old intuitions of what a guitar was. It required someone to be born and to witness the new instrument as a new instrument with a completely new way of seeing. Similarly, I feel that the internet has been around for 30 years, and there are some people who understand what it is capable of, and that is, you know, that you can have peer-to-peer communications, and you can have, you know, back-and-forth feedback in real time and all of those things. But if you look at the biggest stars of, you know, on Instagram, TikTok, YouTube, whatever, and all of those things are innovations on top of old media, but they're still very much informed by old media intuitions. So people still think of themselves as, you know, basically like human billboards, basically. You know, like the peak aspiration is to have as many followers as possible, sell as many products as possible. And I don't begrudge people who aspire to that kind of success. I think, you know, it's a fine thing to want, and it's cool that everyone has the opportunity to do that now, and there's fewer gatekeepers and all those things. But the fundamental possibility of peer-to-peer interaction is something that has not been tested and pushed to its limit. Like, people just don't even think to try it. You know, they don't even think. And part of the tricky thing is, even the people who think to try it, even the people who want to, let's say, have good community spaces and really encourage like scenes to emerge and develop, even if you yourself are able to appreciate that, you know that you still operate in a wider culture where, you know, if you're running a podcast, right, people are going to ask you, how many listeners do you have? How many subscribers do you have? And like, that might not actually be important. Like, maybe the best podcast in the world only has a small number of subscribers who are great. But because you know that, oh, everyone else, when you're at a dinner party or whatever, at the leaderboards are going to be, oh, you should want the guests who will bring you the most listeners, because to be the podcast with the most listeners is the most prestigious and most respected and so on. And so until we shed those assumptions, and I mean, I don't expect that we will shed those assumptions entirely, but until we incubate spaces where people can be free from those assumptions, it will be very difficult to get people to see what are the new possibilities that exist. And I think, and so, and this applies to everything. It applies to monetization. It applies to the incentive structures that people have. There have been signs, you know, I thought, like, if you look back, like, you know, couch surfing was an interesting innovation. This is before Uber and before Airbnb and all of that, right? Like, there was a period of time where And I guess it probably still exists, but I don't know what the current state of it. But, you know, it was an innovation in that it was a cultural innovation, right? Like you using the technical innovation of people being able to message each other anywhere, right? But like the technical ability for people to send emails or to post on message boards or whatever, that existed for some time. But it took a while before like kind of slightly hippie backpackery, you know, folks were able to do these informal couch surfing experiments. And then it took a while longer for more and more people to trust that network, right? And so even on Twitter, for example, my part of Twitter, like my cluster of friends, we have a norm where we quote tweet each other in a supportive and encouraging way, which isn't the mainstream norm of quote tweets on Twitter. Like most people mm-hmm. assume that if someone's quote tweeting someone else, it's to dunk on them and to like make fun of them or whatever. Because that does, and even if that isn't what everyone wants to do, outrage gets you the most engagement. And so when, and then people will see the things that have the most engagement. And so it's like this unfortunate kind of optical illusion / spiraling effect where people begin to believe that the point of quote tweets is to dunk and that everyone who quote tweets does it to dunk because every quote tweet that you see is a dunk because blah, blah, blah. And it doesn't have to be that way. And I think we have successfully demonstrated, at least amongst several, I would say like maybe 20 to 30,000 people-ish who understand that, oh, you can have this nourishing, supportive, encouraging environment of people who use quote tweets in a generous, encouraging, supportive way. And when you have that, you then can cultivate a high trust environment. And when you have a high trust environment, people can do the equivalent of couch surfing, basically. They can do the equivalent of, you know, put each other up at each other's places, travel, visit each other, help each other find jobs, help date, get married, have babies even. And there's all kinds of wonderful second order effects that can happen. My kind of big, audacious, hopeful belief is that we should be able to get that kind of thing happening all over the world in many, many clusters, like at a much larger scale than it. I mean, okay, when I say larger scale, I don't mean, so there's a bunch of confusion here. Because again, when people hear scaling, they tend to think of broadcast, like,
right.
Oh, there's a centralized thing that reaches out very wide. And I'm thinking more of like many independent clusters, like sprouting from many separate localized locations where a few individual community leaders can encourage norms informally in their own respective places. I think that can happen. I think it's already happening. And so like my life's work is to try and like nudge that along. Yeah, it's a lot of stuff, but yeah.
But also where those clusters aren't kind of entirely independent. There's still nodes that are connected or there's some overlap or like some concentric.
Yeah, I would say, kind of yeah, I envision like, so every cluster would have like these switchboard nodes or like the people who are interested in other clusters. And like, and you know, like this isn't entirely new. It isn't like, oh, nobody's done this before, right? Like there are like artist communities and, you know, like I have a friend who does, what does he do? He does Lindy Hop dance and he does parkour. And there's like an international parkour community and, you know, they have like local parkour Facebook groups and like there's like parkour Paris and parkour Singapore and all mm-hmm. of those things. And, you know, if someone in parkour Singapore wants to go and visit Paris, he can have informal. So somebody in parkour Singapore knows somebody in parkour Paris, but not everyone, right? So not everybody in parkour Paris knows everyone in parkour Singapore, but everyone knows someone who knows the person across the bridge node, right? And so as long as like a handful of bridge nodes exist, it's possible for people in one community to like access the people in another community without requiring every single person to be like hypersocial. And yeah, I mean, you know, like church cell groups work like that. There's a whole bunch of other things that work like that. And yeah, I'm trying to, I guess what is kind of new-ish is that we're trying to formulate a version of that that's based on like public discourse, public, I mean, so yeah, I don't want to overly be prescriptive of what sort of people right. I'm talking about because there's many different kinds of people. But like, yeah, I know people who do yoga. I know people who are like very businessy, startup-y, you know, it's like many different kinds of clusters. And it's just, yeah, having lots of clusters, overlapping clusters even, because they don't need to be like hard boundaries. Like people mm-hmm. can participate in multiple communities at once. And then you have some bridge nodes across communities And yeah, I just think that's just you juxtapose this against the general wider sense that, oh, you know, global sense of community is down, religiosity is down, people are going to church less, people have less interest in family, and people have fewer friends. Like, there's all of these very tragic broader trends. And I do believe that, there's a couple of quotes that come to mind for me. One is Margaret Mead saying that, "Never doubt that a small group of committed citizens can change the world. Indeed, it's the only thing that ever has." And then Kurt Vonnegut has a quote that's like, you know, one of the most exciting things that a young person, this was in the 70s, and he's saying one of the most exciting things that a young person can do is just, you know, create enduring communities in which the scourge of loneliness can be defeated. And I'm paraphrasing. But yeah, you know, I think that as long as there are clusters of people trying to do these things informally, in a way that is open and accessible to other people, I think this is a good thing, and I want to see more of it happen.
So two of the kind of qualities of these new networks or the new way of using the internet that I caught on to, mm-hmm. one was right now the incentives are such that it encourages broadcasting. Mm-hmm. So Instagram, TikTok, et cetera, I'm trying to appeal to a broad base, whereas you're, I think, encouraging smaller clusters, but that can be right. interconnected.
Precise, like I do want to be clear that there are Instagrammers and TikTokers who each tend to their like micro niches. Like there is the like mainstream game, which is like the basically Hollywood adjacent kind of like superstar, like Times Square,
which isn't gonna go away.
Social media. But there are, you know, if you go looking for them, I think on every social media platform, there are these nice little niches where people of similar interests like look out for each other. And that is the best way to use the internet, I would say. And I encourage anyone to, even if you're not interested in the stuff I'm saying, like look for the people who are interested in like, you know, like botany or whatever crazy small interest you have, like find the people there. Yeah. Sorry, I interrupted you, but yeah.
No, please. That's the place I was going to go, though. I was going to say, I think first, I think the networks are a function of the platform and like the incentive structure. And so Reddit, for example, I think actually does a pretty good job of what you're describing. Yeah. Most of the people are pseudonymous. So there's like less, I mean, yes, you have karma, you have reputation, but there's less incentive to just like try to attract as many people to upvote your stuff. Like it's more communal and positive sum. And it's by nature built around topics that are subreddits. So I'm wondering how much we're describing a problem that's inherent to TikTok, Instagram, and to some extent Twitter. And if so, is it really just a shift in like a platform shift with incentive changes that we need? Is there ever even a chance that Twitter can evolve to like kind of adapt some of these cultural changes that you're hoping for? Or yeah, maybe again, it's pocket by pocket, it's case by case.
Correct. Yeah. So that's how I think about it. So I grew up in Singapore. I'm still here, and I used to blog on my WordPress blog, which I still have. And I was very passionate as a kid about like, you know, trying to do whatever big idealistic like advocate for whatever big idealistic changes I could think of. And, you know, I think anybody who tries to walk down that path, they get disillusioned pretty quickly because you find that, oh, change is very, very difficult and you need to coordinate a lot of people who are busy and you know, like just trying to get any kind of big thing to change is just a very, very uphill battle. And again, I have a lot of love for anybody who tries, but I have come around to a more like bottom-up way of thinking about these things, which is more of like, instead of like trying to change something big at the top when you are a little person, right? Try and, you know, it's a very, I guess, Gandhi-esque kind of be the change yourself, change, like influence what you can influence, the people around you, assemble a cluster of people. If you can have a healthy cluster of people who are doing well for themselves and each other, then that becomes a desirable place to be. And this could be a subreddit, it could be a part of Twitter, it could be a YouTube channel comment section, right? Like just once you've crafted a nice culture, it could be a cafe, right? It's anything. Once you've made something good, more people will be interested in joining that, and then you get to you get the opportunity slash challenge to how you want to manage that growth. And then, so it's kind of like this concentric circles outwards from the little things. So I don't know what is right for Twitter. You know, like I have like feature requests and stuff that I would like to see, but you know, I don't advise the people who run Twitter, and I don't know what constraints they are operating under. But yeah, so my day to day is like I think about the people that I'm connected to, and I wonder about how can I make their lives better, even just informally as a friend, peer, mentor, whatever. And also, how do I kind of reach out to newer people who don't know who we are or what we do? And yeah, I do. So like, even going back to like my local music scene days, or like even blogging activist-y stuff, there is this recurring problem that's frustrated me all my life, which is that communities become very insular by nature. Like, people just get very swept up in like the local community drama and who is doing too much of this and who is like not like whatever. And I'm always like, oh my God, can we not worry so much about what's happening here and think more about the people who aren't here yet? Like, inviting, growing the pie, basically, instead of fighting over the pie. And I guess that's not very, it's slightly not natural, like in terms of human nature wise, like people are just gonna gossip and argue about how resources are allocated within mm-hmm. the thing. But if you can find people who are kind of like growth minded and you can like encourage those people, I think that you have a better shot at doing these cascading outward changes, right? So one of the things that I did once that's quite popular is I have this meme of a series of dominoes falling over, and like the smallest domino is love and curiosity, the next domino is friendly ambitious nerds, the next domino is high trust scenes of openness and exploration, the next domino is meta scenes of, I might be getting the words a bit mixed up, but like there's bigger and bigger scenes, clusters of scenes, meta scenes, and then I get a bit dramatic. I'm like, shift in global consciousness and golden age for humanity. I mean, so the really big dominoes are all the way out, and like, you know, it's just kind of a fantasy dream to orient towards. But in the short run, it's really, how can you be like a loving, curious presence in your own life? And then how can you kind of spread that to other people around you? And then how can you, you know, as I'm saying this, I realize that there are parallels with like stuff religious people say. And like, yeah, sure, why not? You know, I don't consider myself particularly religious in any particular school of thought, but like, you know, like again, going back to like, I have a couple of blog posts about like how libraries are kind of my cathedrals in my DIY religion, sort of like lighthouses. I think of them as like lighthouses to the light of human consciousness. And, you know, there have been people from all over the world in different languages, different ethnicities, different religions, whatever. And they were all participating in this grand enterprise of learning and sharing. And so like, you can find beautiful quotes from like Al-Mamun, who was the caliph of Baghdad, and he was saying like, through learning and sharing, like great wonders including peace are possible. Like, oh, what a beautiful quote from like this you know, this Islamic sultan from like the year 800, you know, like, so, and I have quotes like these from people all over the world from hundreds and thousands of years ago. And there's just this sense of this, I have the sense of this great enterprise that has been going on for long before we were born, and hopefully will go on long after we are gone. And this is a sense of continuity, the sense of tradition even. And it's very much, again, it's like, it's what I think a lot of people want that they feel that they don't have in like a modern consumerist capitalist, or like, I gotta, and I mean, I'm not even saying like I'm against capitalism or whatever. Like, I, you know, I'm a business owner. I'm fine. It's just, but I think when people's frustrations are, you know, like, oh my God, like, do I have to like try and get the most views or make the most money or like really squeeze everything to be like, have a brand and present myself a certain way? Like, there's a lot of pressure to succeed fast. And like, I think having longer views on like these bigger, broader, like, you know, one of my friends was saying that the beautiful thing about churches these days, even if you're not religious, is that it's one of the few places you can go in and there's like no advertising blasting at you. And it's just that, oh yeah, like, it, and nature is other, like, you go into nature and there's like no ads, and yeah,
they're yeah, protected.
Exactly. So it's nice to be in spaces where you don't feel like you are being advertised to, or you are under pressure to advertise to other people. And, you know, I mean, again, if you look back, there's like, it's not like the past was free of those things. We do romanticize the past in ways that, mm-hmm. apparently even during like the gladiator battles and stuff, they had ads, which is pretty funny to think about. But yeah, you know, I think that there should be some part of daily life or weekly life or whatever that is, where you feel relief from this constant pressure and intensity or whatnot. And I think we can find it in ourselves, and we can provide it amongst ourselves with other people. And I think that's just a very, once you've seen how people light up in a space where they feel like, oh, I can just relax, I can just be myself and not stress. Like, it's such a wonderful gift to give people that. So I feel like I've been able to do this for some other people. I set out to do it for myself, first of all, like when I was a teenager and feeling overwhelmed in life and what, I'm like, okay, I don't want to be so stressed all the time. I want to understand stuff and do a bunch of reading and figure stuff out. So I figured some stuff out for myself. And then I found that I was able to like be such a presence in other people's lives. And then now I'm like, oh, well, like, why would I limit myself to like, I'm just going to do this for like a dozen people and then I'm done. Like, right. I could, but like, if I can help more kids like myself, like I want to. Yeah.
Well, and you're largely only ever doing it for yourself, and everyone else is a byproduct of it, right? Like, look at your most recent book. Introspection is a single player individual game, but the output of that, when you do it publicly, it becomes something, it becomes more communal and positive sum. To go back to your domino meme, you've probably said this elsewhere before, but do you view yourself or your objective as kind of incubating this like meta scene from which these other scenes can stem? Like, you want to create the environment with the right philosophy, the right conditions that help other people create their own subsequent scenes?
I would say that actually not that much. Like, so I like to dream big from time to time. I like to sit down and like, let's imagine a beautiful future, and that's what the beautiful future looks like. But once I do that, I always go back to like people, and I'm always like, who are the next like handful of people that I should be talking to? Who can I speak to that will make a difference, right? And like, who, I mean, so if I had a literal organization, I guess I would be thinking, who can I recruit? Who can I promote? Who can I, like, those things. But I don't have a, it's like, but this is informal. So it's not like I have like jobs and whatnot. But like, I'm always kind of talking to people, and like, you know, I used to have a really difficult time explaining what I'm trying to do until I recently watched this, not that recent, but like, there's this Netflix special called The Black Godfather. And it's about this guy called Clarence Avant. And Clarence Avant, he was sort of like the behind the scenes guy around the same time. So him and Quincy Jones are good friends. And Quincy Jones is kind of well known. He's like a music producer. He made his own songs. He, you know, worked with Michael Jackson, Frank Sinatra. Like, if you follow Quincy Jones' life, it seems surreal. Like, he's just everywhere in all the, everyone he meet. He discovered Oprah. Like, it's just crazy. It's like he's, and Clarence Avant was sort of like parallel with Quincy, but behind the scenes. And he was just, you know, orchestrating everything. Like, he was just like making introductions. And it's not like he was, I think he ran like an artist management company at some point, but like, and then he shuttered it or something. But everyone just respected him, trusted him, admired him. They would go to him for counsel. They would listen to his suggestions, and he would say, you should meet that guy. You should talk to those people. You should produce a movie with this person. And like, he would like negotiate disputes and stuff. And basically, it seems to me, and maybe I'm buying into the PR a little bit, but it seems to me that Clarence and Quincy were disproportionately responsible for like, black entertainment really coming up in those decades. I mean, there's also like broader trends and stuff beyond that. Sure. But when you really hear the stories, you're like, wow, these people were like orchestrating a lot, you know. And that's kind of, you know, I'm not going to say that I'm the same as that, but like, it's kind of the kind of thing I want
to
do.
What you aspire to.
Yeah, yeah. And I've been reading history, and there's other things, like, you know, anytime you look at any great historical figure, like, always, so my habit now is anytime I read about anybody like that, I investigate their social environment, and there's always something going on. So like Einstein, for example, he would hang out at Max Planck's house, and Max Planck and his wife, they would organize house parties, and all these physicists would come, and they would play music, and they would just talk, and like, that was like this important scene building environment. And there's just always something like that in you know, like C.S. Lewis and J.R.R. Tolkien, they would hang out at a pub, I think, and they had a whole, like, they were each other's like alpha readers in a way. And it makes sense. Like you need someone to impress and be impressed by, to kind of challenge right. each other to go far beyond like what is like the market wants, right? Because like market forces, I think only explain like maybe half of like outlier success. Like outlier success, I think, requires productive rivalries, because you need people to do things that is far, like far beyond what the market would even know to want, right? Yeah. So I'm obsessed with this. Like, I probably will write a book about this. Maybe I'll write a bunch of essays. Like, there's this idea of like productive rival. I mean, there are a bunch of books already, but like, I don't understand yet why these books that already exist aren't more popular and we aren't obsessing about them all the time. This is a great essay by, I think his name is Adam Banks, or maybe David Banks. I mix up the names, but like, he's a statistician. And in 1997, he wrote an essay that said, the title is "The Problem of Excess Genius." So you can Google that. And it basically opens with, you know, why are some periods of time so much, and like in localized spaces in space and time, so much more productive than others, right? And how I tell the story is like, again, if you look at history, it's tempting to think that progress is like kind of linear and slow and steady over time. But when you actually look at history, it's like there are these explosions of productivity, during golden ages, in the Gupta golden age in India, they invented zero. And in the Baghdad golden age, they invented like chemistry and astronomy. And then the Chinese one, like in the Qing, I think, they invented like gunpowder and paper. And there's the Renaissance in Florence, and like, you know, the Shakespeare's era in London, the Dutch golden age. There are all these, it's almost creepy how few people are responsible for a tremendous amount of human progress. And we, as a species, we hardly seem to really properly appreciate this. Like, I mean, maybe like people in top universities and like startup founders and venture capitalists and like, I don't know, the people like, maybe like presidents and stuff appreciate that. But is that enough? I don't think so. I feel like everyone should understand it. Like, as a species, we should understand that progress happens in clusters. And if we want progress, we should be studying these clusters and trying to recreate them as much as possible, right? So that, and especially that
those environments.
Exactly.
And now your work makes a lot more sense. What you're trying to do is pull together these like-minded people who could have potentially outsized impact, but need that, call it competition, call it, refinement through conversations with one another. But talent might be evenly distributed, but like the opportunity for you to connect with somebody else who can help push you to that next level is still kind of a missing link to this.
Exactly.
Are you hopeful that we can, this feels like a solvable problem, frankly, like, especially once everyone's online.
There's this letter from Marshall McLuhan to Ezra Pound in, I think, the 40s. And it's so sad to read, because Marshall is like, you know, I want to bring together 10 really talented people that I know from like all over the world, or like from many different cities and universities and stuff. But like, I can't even communicate with them. I can't even like, and you know, they didn't have email. They didn't have Twitter. They had to write letters to each other back and forth, and it would take like weeks or whatever. And he was just almost, I mean, I maybe I'm projecting. I feel like it's kind of sad, the letter. He's like, I can't even get people to like come together to hang out. But like, if we could have those 10 excellent minds in the same room and live in the same city and just exist together, they would do great things. And what I really like about that is I feel that he understood that the point of getting great minds in the same room is not to tell them what to do, but to allow the minds to collectively figure out what to do. Because like, the group mind is going to be smarter than any individual mind. So you shouldn't preemptively say, we're going to do X. You should see what comes up, right? But like, they didn't have Twitter, right? Like, I always think about how Da Vinci and Guru Nanak, so Guru Nanak was the founder of Sikhism in India, they were alive at the same time, but they would have no idea that each other existed, because there was no Twitter, there was no internet. So yeah, you know, and you know what's funny? Like, while I was tweeting about like, oh, we want to do a golden age someday, like when I then started kind of like investigating stuff, and like looking at Wikipedia and YouTube and Twitter and like the amount of scholarship that comes out of that and the interactions and everything, like I think the case could be made that we are actually in a golden age right now, and we don't even realize it yet. And like, that was true of past golden ages as well, I think. I think it's only like in retrospect that it becomes clear, like, oh, that was a really productive period of time. And
you only notice it in hindsight.
Yeah.
Well, so this has me excited as well. But I noticed a, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but there's a trend or like an undercurrent in your work and your efforts that is, you want it to feel a little more informal and like authentic. You don't, you come from a marketing background, but you don't want to feel kind of grifty and push things on people. Yet, if I told you, like, if you did those things and you tried like 50% harder and maybe had to craft a story that feels a little gamey, but you achieved this outcome, would you? Like, why don't you want to employ those tactics that you know towards these ends?
Yeah, it's a good question. I am like turning the knob very like slowly, but I do intend to turn the knob. But the reason I didn't turn it all the way is because I have, you know, I've been around long enough to witness how these things play out. And one of the tragic things that happens is that like people with good intentions kind of like are very vocal about what great outcomes they want to achieve. And the problem with that is that it attracts the kind of person who, again, I don't want to say negative things about them, but like they are not quite the right people who you want working on these problems. Like, so there is a, you know, it's like when you say, hey, we're going to build scenes, we're going to do these exciting things. The people who want to come tend to be the people who just want to hang out, want to have a good time, want to gain status. And that those are not bad things to do. Like, I do think that everyone in the scene should be like benefit from participating, but you need people who want to do the work, people who are, and like to select for those people and to not like, you have to get the ratios right. I didn't quite know how to formulate this before, but yeah, like you have to, there has to be some percentage of like creatives and like scholars, whether like part of institutions or not. Like this, you need the creatives, you need the scholars, you need the cultural output producers, and you also need people who are investing financially, even like whether people who are like patrons or people who are paying audience members or whatever. Like you need some amount of all of those things. But if you're overly vocal about it and you like say, oh, we're gonna start a company, or you know, so I my personal view, and I don't know if I'm right, right? And I encourage people to do whatever they think is right. But like, I think anything where you're like, I'm going to start a paid community, or I'm going to start, you know, like, so I have friends who are interested in like charter cities, and I hope it succeeds. But my instinct is that probably won't, because like, again, it's like the same like kind of hiring recruitment problem where the people who most show up for the interviews and stuff are the people who want the prestige potentially associated with the thing, and not like, so even if it were theoretically possible with the right people in the room, it's very hard to get the right people in the room. So it's almost like you have to promise, like this is really funny. I'm reminded of this, like, I don't know if it's real or not, but it's this job description from like a century ago, maybe, of like expedition, like men wanted for like difficult expedition, hard labor, poor, like poor rations.
The Shackleton expedition.
Yes, exactly. Yeah. Survival unlikely, glory if you survive, right? Like, so you kind of need some form of that. Like, you need people who are, I mean, even that's a bit extreme, I don't know, but like, yeah.
No, I
like,
get what you're saying. That you're saying it, when you are very outward and like descriptive in your ends and pretty forceful, you attract a particular type of person.
Yeah.
It almost comes down to like extrinsic versus intrinsic.
Yes.
Whereas you, through authenticity, you think that you'll attract those more intrinsically motivated people, where whether naturally or over time, the incentives and like expectations that come about or emerge are more aligned with the ends than what otherwise gets created through like the marketing, the force.
Right.
I don't have
I can even tell you about like, I can even tell you about like a kind of complicated challenge that like well-intentioned people I know have struggled with. And like, so it's like, let's say you want to invest, like you want to start investing some money in encouraging people to be more creative or to produce stuff or whatever. So one of the ways people try to do this is, okay, let's come up with grants, right? Let's pay people to start blogs or podcasts or such and such. And the tricky thing is, even here, right, like you end up with well-meaning, like grant, like I don't know if I want to call them grant seekers, but like affirmation seekers, I guess. So like people who I'm not very sure of themselves, but they feel like, oh, if I qualify for this grant, then like that means I'm doing something right. And so they don't actually yet have an internal drive, intrinsic motivation to do the blog or the podcast or the YouTube channel or whatever, but they want to get the grant to feel good about themselves, which, you know, again, they deserve to feel good about themselves. Sure. But like, you know, you then give them the grant, they perform well enough for the criterion of the grant, but like most of the time they don't really continue. Like, I mean, they might do like 3 or 4 things and then they don't. And, you know, and maybe even if you're giving out like 10 grants and like 9 of them turn out to not be that great or like not follow through, but that last one happens to really go all the way, then it's like it was worthwhile to do that grant. Mm-hmm. But it's just a tricky problem, I guess, in general. Like
it really is. What are the analogs or like case studies you can point to where these outsized impact scenes emerged without force? Like you look at all modern companies mm-hmm. fall into the latter camp, like the extrinsically motivated, more or less, I would say. Yeah. So I'm trying to figure out, like, is this to not put it lightly, to not sugarcoat it, like, is this wishful thinking? Do you have to borrow at least somewhat from this other camp, this other mentality, to reach your ends, even if it feels disingenuous or inauthentic? Case studies? What are the analogs?
So you're asking about like historical examples of scenes working out that were like explicit or not explicit?
Non-explicit. More in line with what you're trying to achieve or cultivate.
Oh, I mean, there's tons and tons of these. But like, I mean, tons and tons in sense of like too many to list on one podcast, but like not enough like globally. Like globally, I would say, yeah, I'm guessing there's like been like a 100-ish, right? And there should be, my wish is that there be thousands, but there have been like 100-ish, I feel. And it's usually clusters of creatives, you know, like people who, you know, and one of the examples I always think of is like reggae in Jamaica. Like they basically invented the genre by themselves, and they had a small-ish scene of musicians who performed it. And then there was this one guy, I can't remember his name, but he started this company called Island Records, and Island Records kind of like promoted reggae beyond Jamaica, and that became an international phenomenon. And he borrowed like $5,000 of money from his parents, which is like, oh, if some people are like, oh, you know, you took your parents' money, but like for $5,000, if you can like birth a whole genre of music to the world that the rest of the world enjoys for the rest of time, that's an incredible use of $5,000, right? But no, sorry, you're asking about like successful scenes. What else are my favorites?
No, I think you gave an example, and as I'm like mulling it over myself, I think there's far more examples.
A
new thought came to me, which also might be that a lot of these scenes are initially born or emerged through, we need to find the right like dichotomous terms here, but I'll stick with intrinsic versus extrinsic. Are born from intrinsic means, like reggae music, for example. I imagine it was just a bunch of people who got together and said, we want to create cool music. Right. But then there are these extrinsic motivators that come into play as it becomes more of like a venture, or there's like financial considerations or status considerations. Right. So that's maybe what propels it to the next level. And then you could argue to some extent dies out and the cycle starts again.
Exactly. There's a great post by David Chapman. It's called Geeks, Mops, and Sociopaths. And his thesis is that it's about the life cycle of subcultures. And he says basically subcultures begin with a bunch of geeks who just love something, right? It could be comic books. It could be, you know, physics. It could be like computers before computers became an industry, right? So a bunch of people who are reggae music as well. Like, so they were like rhythm and music geeks, right? Like they just enjoyed the thing for the sake of the thing. And they're just having fun. And once a bunch of people are having fun, then you have other people who show up because, hey, those people are having fun. So they want to hang out and have fun with those people. And then once you have a whole cluster of people, then like the profiteering people observe, hey, like we can make money from this, you know, we can whatever. And like,
exactly,
you know, some amount of profit and money making and industry is healthy because it lets people make a living and stuff. But at the same time, you know, like often the case, like the earliest group of geeks, they're like not socially very adept, you know, they don't necessarily know how to handle money. Sometimes the worst thing that can happen to a geek is like a bit of success and then it goes to their head, or they don't know how to manage mm-hmm. it, or they don't like it. Just, it can be very tragic when you see a case where like a like socially maladjusted geek gains some financial success, some material success, and he doesn't know how to act, right? And then he like, all kinds of terrible things can happen. So yeah, it's like, it's really, when you examine multiple clusters of these things and you see how it plays out, there's like, there's so many failure modes, right? There's so many ways things can die. Like you can be, oh, the cluster is too insular and so everyone gets sick of each other, or they get bored and quit. Or there's too much ambition that is very extrinsic and like nobody's having fun anymore, and then it goes corporate and bland and shitty and it dies that way. Mm-hmm. So it's like, it's this very delicate balancing act. And now I'm reminded of how Miles Davis's drummer described his bands. And so Miles Davis is a great example to study because he performed in many different bands. He was like a band master of a lot of different bands. And repeatedly, the group of musicians that he would bring together, they would each go on to start their own, like what's his name? Herbie Hancock played with Miles, and then now he's like Herbie Hancock. And it's like, this, everybody who associated with Miles went on to become a superstar of their own. So he clearly understood something about how to manage talent, how to bring people together, challenge them to like push boundaries, and like I think how the drummer described it was, he said he wanted them to kind of explode dangerously but safely on stage every night. And like, you know, he would say, he'll tell them to make mistakes live and correct them on stage, and then the drummer would say, oh, the audience won't like that, and Miles would say, you don't worry about the audience, you just play, I'll handle the public. Mm-hmm. Right? And it's just all these little details that's very, as you study more and more examples of all of these scenes, I find that, so every scene needs to have or practice some sort of deviance, like deviance from mainstream norms and culture. Because again, if you're just doing what mainstream norms and culture is doing, then you're not going to innovate in any interesting way. But being deviant is like socially challenging, and like most people have like internal protection mechanisms to keep them from deviating too far from the norm, because you're going to get mm-hmm. punished socially for being weird, right? And so a scene becomes a space where people tolerate transgression and weirdness and deviance in some domain. Like, so even like, if you think about it now, like the earliest YouTubers or the earliest TikTokers, or, like they were like, it was a strange thing to want to do, right? And so right. they needed the support of each other to try something, even without any financial reward yet, like for the love of the game or whatever, right? And yeah, so you have to have that. You have to tolerate deviance. You have to, somebody has to be like the people person. Somebody yeah. has to be like the money person. Like there's all these complicated things that have to be managed. And very often, you know, like I remember reading about David Ogilvy and advertising, and he was saying that, oh man, the best copywriters had the most atrocious manners. They were just like, you know, like not fun people to be like working, like just all kinds of, and same for like the early days of jazz, everyone was like on drugs, it was a mess, but yeah, they were on to something.
You don't get those kinds of outputs if you're if all the areas of your life are perfectly sound, you don't get those outputs. You have to trade off in other areas.
Yeah, there's a Kanye quote where he says, if you want these crazy lights and this crazy music and this crazy stage, it probably comes from a crazy person. It's like, that's true.
Yeah, there's I talked about this topic with a couple other people on the podcast, actually, David Perel and Jeremy Jaffon. Jeremy Jaffon has this great thread that I'll share with you, where he talks about weirdos. He calls them weirdos. These are the equivalent of deviants, and how we have this interesting relationship in society with them, where we commend them for what they give us. So take Elon, for example. Yeah. It's like, oh yeah, thank you for bringing us Tesla and SpaceX and whatever. But also, can you comply with the rest of society? Like, why are you being so weird? And why are you so outspoken like this? And it's like, well, you don't get both. We have to tolerate mm-hmm. your outlandishness if we also want the innovations you bring. And for some reason, society, like, mm-hmm. we almost accept it in hindsight. Like, we celebrate Michael Jordan in hindsight for having been this absurd competitor. But in the moment, I'm sure a lot of his teammates and fans mm-hmm. were like, why are you such a dick? But society has to come around to that idea in the moment, yeah. I think, for this to fully actualize.
One of the funny jokes I always remember is, I can't remember who was it who said, but I think Alan Watts, maybe? Somebody said, like, imagine being Shakespeare's English teacher. And he would have been, like, you know, coming up with new words, and, like, the teacher would be like, that's not a word. And he'd be like, it will be. Right? And, like, it must have been insufferable, like, to deal with, right? And, yeah, so we want to enjoy the fruits of deviant, weirdo labors, but we don't want them to do it right. Like, do you have to do that now?
Yeah.
I know there's a quote in India that's like, everyone wants a freedom fighter, but like in the neighbor's house. You know, like you don't want your son to be like fighting against the government, right? You want somebody to be fighting tyranny, but like, must it be my son? You know, and so it's like, yeah, it's very society needs safe spaces for deviants, and not even saying safe spaces is not quite the right phrase. You know, it's just, I guess, and again, it's like
non-judgmental spaces, I think, might be a good phrase for it.
Right. And like, deviants, like there's a kind of Joker, Batman, you complete me kind of thing, where like, again, what is considered normal is defined in relation to what is not normal. So it's like, there's this yin yang, like the center needs the periphery to define the center. Kind of, we should be like, I'm not sure people really, really grok that. Like, I've had smart friends who struggle with understanding, like, oh, why is, I'm just trying to do good. Why are people being mean to me? But like, when you're trying to do good, you're being deviant. You're trying to be, even if you're trying to be like positively deviant, you imply that the norm is not good, right? There's something wrong with being, and like, yeah, this, I can talk about that for hours. Like, just the ways in which simply trying to be, you know, uncommonly kind, thoughtful, supportive, encouraging, like all of those things. People will pay lip service to it to some degree when you're still kind of just casual. But as you start to succeed, and like, that will make other people uncomfortable. And it's just, it's a whole tricky thing to navigate. And I do find that some of my, even if I don't personally do like out like Michael Jordan level stuff in my own life, I think I've spent enough time studying the space and talking to enough people that I can probably be like a, I don't know if therapist is the right word or coach or whatever, but like I can guide people through thinking about these problems, because there's not a lot of sympathy for the struggles of deviants, you know, like for Elon or whatever. Like, once you cross some level of notoriety or success, people just think, ah, it comes with the territory, so that people are going to insult you and make fun of you or whatever. But like, yeah, imagine what it's like, you know, I've told this to multiple people, like, imagine what it's like to be Elon or Kanye or Napoleon, right? Where people tell you that, oh, you can't be emperor of France. Like, that's not possible. There's no such thing as emperor of France. And then you do it. So you've now done something that everyone tells you is impossible, which must feel amazing at one level, but it also feels insane. People, like your own friends, tell you, you can't land a rocket. Like, nobody has ever landed a rocket. Are you going to spend $500 million trying to land? Please, as your friends and family, we are very concerned that you're trying to land a rocket. Like, it's never been done. Please stop wasting your money. And then you land the rocket and everyone's like, oh, shit. But now, how can you trust anyone who says anything to you about what can or cannot be done, right? Which is like, that must be insane. It must literally drive you insane, because like, if you think of sanity as being well adjusted to social norms,
right?
Like, you now know that social norms are wrong. But this reality still exists. So Napoleon might have thought, oh, well, people told me I couldn't be emperor of France, and now they're telling me I can't invade Russia in the winter. Like, they're just telling me shit. And then you try and then you fail. So like, a tweet I had was like, people who have accomplished like the unthinkable, they are almost cursed to die attempting the impossible. Because to them, it's like,
you have to keep pushing boundaries.
Where's the line? Yeah, exactly. Which again, I'm not even saying people should like Elon or Kanye, or like, again, they're like, being deviants is very naturally makes a person unlikable. But like, I think society would benefit from just stepping back to consider what that experience is like. Like, just to imagine what it's like to do something that was, until you did it, was inconceivable to society. And like, that will, I think, as more people consider that properly, we may expand the possibility space, right? Of like, what is possible and what is conceivable,
right?
Yeah,
when we give more allowances for that kind of behavior.
Yeah. So like, even just when you step back and you think, oh, the like circle of conceivability is smaller than the circle of possibility. Which is
As you were talking, the like a visual that came to me was basically the Overton, like the Overton window. Exactly. The deviants are on the fringe of that. Mm-hmm. And when you're on the fringe of something, push it, like literally push, visualize them pushing the, mm-hmm. the window forward. Like there's a lot of friction there. People at the people towards the back are frustrated that this is being pulled forward. Mm-hmm. But also to continue with the earlier conversation we were having about like the life cycle of subcultures or innovation, that's that innovation normally becomes normalized at a certain point. Like the Overton window almost re-centers itself on that. And so we constantly need those deviants to be pushing forward this window. But an interesting visualization of that. So I read Friendly Ambitious Nerds. When did you publish it? 4 years ago? 3 years ago?
February 2020.
So 3 years ago. So I read it when it first came out, and then I read it again over the course of the last week in preparation for this. And then started, I admittedly didn't get through Introspect, but want to go back and finish it. I think I'm curious about like the internal or like psychological journey you went on over, I don't know what the span of time was between when you finished Friendly Ambitious Nerd to when you started Introspect. I imagine it was almost instantly. Also, these ideas are always in the background processing anyway.
I was actually working on Introspect before Friendly Ambitious Nerd. Like I had notes and everything. Yeah.
So, well, then maybe that renders my question moot. But like, maybe to shift the question, it's why was the timing right to finish that piece? And the larger kind of context that I want to project here is, felt like there was a shift from, Friendly Ambitious Nerd is almost like an outward looking thing. It's like this correct. Is the thing I'm portraying to the world, and then Introspect mm-hmm. is like I'm going deeper on myself.
That's exactly it. Yeah.
And I imagine that mirrors the journey you were having, although they were somewhat, they're always happening in parallel.
Correct.
So just like why was this the right time? And any other thoughts about that progression thinking that led to the work?
Yeah. I mean, so the one word answer is COVID, basically. But I mean, in more words, I've always been meaning to write Introspect, but I actually thought it would take me a much longer time. I thought I would write it. So I thought I would be like assembling drafts and notes and like, you know, every time I would have a conversation with someone in my DMs. So I get a lot of people asking me for advice in my DMs, usually younger guys who are struggling with stuff. And I mean, I read a lot of advice columns when I was like a teenager. And so I've synthesized a lot of that information and I've thought about it and stuff like that. And people just tell me all the time in my DMs, like, oh, like they ask me for help. And then they come back like months later saying, hey, I tried the stuff you're saying and like it totally worked and I'm doing much better now. And I'm like, wow, like if I can have that impact on people in my DMs, like, wouldn't it be nice to like publish something more substantial to help more people? Mm-hmm. And well, I underestimated how difficult that would be because like in DMs, you can have back and forth, like they say something, then you respond to that. And if it's not working, you change it. Whereas like if you're going to write a book, like you have to account for all the possibilities and you can't control how their response is going to be. So that's a much harder challenge. And so I thought it would take me like another 10 years. I thought I would write it in my 40s or something. And my plan was after Friendly Ambitious Nerd was, I wasn't even planning on writing. I was planning on traveling. Like my plan was to visit every major city. So like I had booked tickets for New York in April 2020 and then the pandemic hit. Yeah. So now I'm stuck at home. I'm like, oh, well, I guess I should. And I would do a bunch of like inter-intellect salons. So my friend Anna, she runs this thing, which is like Zoom calls for like during the pandemic. It's like Zoom calls for people to just discuss stuff. And I would host these sessions to like 30 people and we talk about meaning and whatever. And it just clarified for me that, oh, you know, a lot of people are kind of, one, that everyone's stuck at home, right? And everyone's kind of rethinking their lives, thinking their careers and rethinking everything. And so that just felt like a kind of, like, it's like the universe or like, I guess the virus, however you want to frame it, right? Just external reality constrained me in a way that kind of drove me inwards. And I'm like, well, I might as well just try and get this done and be done with it. And I'm kind of great. Like, so it's kind of a silver lining, I guess. It remains to be seen. It's still fairly early because like now that I've published Introspect, it's the book that people that I mean, so people read both books or they read one or the other depending on what they think they need. And but Introspect goes much deeper inwards into people's like personal issues and stuff. And so I get much more heartfelt reader feedback from that. It's very intimate, very you know, like every week or so someone's like, oh my god, you changed my life. And it's like, it's always amazing to receive. And I cannot anticipate how much that will shape me in like the coming decade, as opposed to like, so having published that at 32 instead of at 30, 31 ish instead of at 40, like I have a whole decade of reader feedback now to kind of like stew on. But yeah, so I wasn't actually planning to publish it that quickly, but and yet it did take me longer than I at the point the pandemic started, I decided I'm just gonna write a fairly short book like Friendly Ambitious Nerd. But the book kind of took on a life of its own. Like it was demanding me take it more seriously and make it deeper and more intense. And yeah, it really consumed me for like the whole of 2020, 2021. But I'm very glad I did it. It's really, I almost can't believe that I did it. It was so intense. But yeah, it's, you know, so I got a tattoo of a labyrinth to commemorate that. It's one of the central motifs of the book. And I got it to commemorate the publishing of the book. I feel like a different person having written it. And now I am quite eager to update Friendly Ambitious Nerd having, so like, once I wrote my second book, my first book doesn't even feel like a real book because that was just like, I'm just throwing together some Twitter threads and blog posts and like stapling it together and be like, this is a collection of my stuff. It's not really, like, writing a book is an interesting experience. It's like a psychologically challenging experience. If you're very serious about trying to write a good book, like the being like the custodian of that entire process from page one to page like 200, 300, you can't even keep it all in your head at once. So like, there's all kinds of things that go into that. That is, it's a very transformative kind of psychedelic experience of creativity. And so if anybody feels that they are supposed to write a book in some way, so if you don't feel it, don't bother. Like write essays or blog posts or whatever. But if you feel that I have to write a book for some reason, like in your heart, you feel that you have to write a book, do it. Because you will be a different person at the end of it. Even if it's not a very, like, even if you feel that, that's kind of it was not what I was hoping for, or whatever. Like the process of doing it will transform you in some ways.
What's the next book on the docket, or is the plan to go back, like you said, and revise Friendly Ambitious Nerd? Because I'm, not that there has to be like an arc or a you know, kind of hero's journey to this, but I'm wondering where you focused on this as like the outward kind of persona I portray to the world. Now I'm going in. I don't know where you go from there. Is it transcending all of this, or
I have a whole bunch of stuff. So like when I wrote Friendly Ambitious Nerd, I did not have a grand vision for the book. I just had I asked people how they introduced me, and I just kind of stapled a bunch of stuff together.
Right.
But once I've published it and I've shared it with people and I've had conversations about it, I've started to see that it's like a whole operating system or a way of being that implies this greater philosophy of how to be. So all the stuff I've told you about, like, you know, scenes and like people from all over the world who were switchboards and like, so people that I would describe as Friendly Ambitious Nerds in history. I don't mention any of that much. I don't mention much of that in the book. I mention like Pythagoras, I think. Well, that's about it. But like, there's so much more that I don't mention in the book. And like the Domino's meme, I came up with it after publishing the book. So there's all these ideas that I've developed further that I could not have developed until after writing the book that I feel deserve to go into the book. So I will definitely update Friendly Ambitious Nerd. I have a few like drafts of possible books. I have like these Google Docs. One is called Constructive ADHD, which is just like a bunch of notes on how to be ADHD and productive. A lot of people like that. I have some notes on like being more strategic, and I have a bunch of notes. One is called Optics, which is like just about public image and how people see and ways of seeing and photography and smartphones and all of those things. But it's kind of, you know, I don't know if it wants to be a book. It might be a series of essays. And I'm pretty excited about I'm trying to do a bunch of essays on Substack. I do feel that a book is a large ask of a reader, especially like, you know, in this day of like information overload, like nobody has time to read books, you know, like everyone has,
unfortunately.
I mean, you can try, but like you have a list, everyone has a list of books that they want to get around to reading eventually. And like, I'm already, people who follow me on Twitter, they're already like, oh, I know Visa's tweets are nice and he has a couple of books, but do I want to read the books? I don't know if I can make time, whatever. So like to make a third book, it's like now there's three things you got to read, right? So in between, I feel like essays are like, oh, you can read them in 5 minutes to 10, 15 minutes-ish, like on the train or on the bus or in the toilet, whatever. And yeah, I would like a collection of really good essays that I can just share with people. But so the thing that I realized, so like Friendly Ambitious Nerd is like a bit of people sense, like how to interface with other people, a bit of culture sense, and Introspect is very much self sense, like your sense within yourself. And I do feel that I have a lot of things to say about culture broadly that I don't really address in Friendly Ambitious Nerd or in Introspect. I could theoretically write a third book about culture, and I guess Optics is kind of like that, but I think it'll be more fun as a series of essays. So I really just want to write a lot of essays, and it will function as like onboarding ramps to my books in some ways.
Right.
And maybe some of the essays will cluster together to be a book. Maybe not. I don't know. We'll see.
One of the impressions I got is in that response is that you don't force the process. You had a line that was like, I don't know if it wants to become a book. To what extent do you, like, how do you know when to push that button? How do you know when it's ready? It's just a feeling, an instinct.
Yeah.
Or is it when people are clamoring? Is it more external? Is it when people are clamoring for it? Or
That's a good question. Yeah, I'm still feeling it out. You know, like so Friendly Ambitious Nerd was people are asking me, people wanna give me money for a bunch of writing. And it was important to me that like whatever the first debut thing that I sell, it shouldn't be overly niche in a narrow way. Like, so I'm good at marketing, but I don't want to write a book about marketing and have that be, people introduce me as, this is Visa, he wrote this book about marketing.
Right.
Like, must I be introduced that way? And so, yeah, so I enjoyed that I titled my book in a way that I like to be introduced. And it's almost like a mantra, like every time people introduce, oh, this is Visa, he's the author of Friendly Ambitious Nerd. It's like, I guess I should live up to that name. Like, I should try and be more friendly, more ambitious, more nerdy.
Yeah.
So that's great.
Can we pause there for a second? I love those axes or those attributes of friendly, ambitious, and nerd. I'm curious which ones. I imagine you wouldn't consider yourself 10 out of 10 on all of those.
Mm-hmm.
Which ones are you trying to get better at? Where are you and where are you trying to get better? So,
ambition is actually like my weak spot. Like I'm least like I'm so like I would say. I was like almost born a nerd, like or like I was a nerd from I was struck with nerdness from a very young age, and I taught myself to be more friendly, as part because of my social environment and I wanted other nerd friends or whatever. And then ambition, I would say, it's almost it doesn't come naturally to me. You know, once in a while I meet someone who's naturally ambitious, like someone who wakes up in the morning and they're like, I'm gonna seize the day. I'm not like that. I wake up, I'm like, what's going on? I'm kind of sleepy still. You know, my ambition is almost, I wouldn't say I reasoned myself into it, but like I have to cultivate it. You know, I have to remind myself of the, so I've had experiences where I feel like if only I had prepared more or I had spoken to more people or I had done more XYZ, I would be better able to like deal with some problem or like address some issue. And yeah, so I'm trying to be more ambitious, and maybe if I were more naturally ambitious, I would have already turned the knob further earlier, sooner. I don't know. Like,
right.
You know, so the way that we do what we do is who we are. Right. And, so I'm well, very naturally curious about random nonsense all the time. I'm very naturally, let's say nerd, I would put myself as like an 8. And friend, I would put myself as like a 7. Like I can, again, I've met people who are like 8, 9, 10 on friends. Like they're just naturally charismatic. You know, like if you hear anybody describe like Bill Clinton or Arnold Schwarzenegger, like they walk into a room and they're just, hey, how are you? How's it going? I'm like, I have to like psych myself up a little bit. I can, but it doesn't, you know, just like burst out of me like that. And I do, my social battery does deplete eventually, which for some people it doesn't. It blows my mind. And then for ambition, I'm like a 6 or like a 5.56-ish. Like I'm trying to cultivate all of those things and get better at it.
Going back to our conversation about deviants or weirdos, and that, and correct me if you don't agree with this, but trading off in one area of life, or having outsized impact in one area of life, trades off in some other area. How do you cultivate those things without losing like your essence or who you are?
Interesting question. I mean, at some levels, I think some of the trade-offs that I made were like apparent from a pretty young age. Like, I was never, you know, and there's this great interview with R.I.P. Kobe Bryant and Arianna Huffington, I think. And he was saying that he's not a good friend. You know, he doesn't remember people's birthdays. R.I.P. But like, and I like how he framed it. He's like, it's not a strength. It's not something to brag about. It's like a weakness. It's just how he is or was. Mm-hmm. Like, he just couldn't. And like, there are some ways in which I'm like that. Like, you know, I can, like, my life is not very glamorous. Like, I tweet a lot. I'm like sitting in a room, reading books, reading notes and that kind of thing. And it's like, I'm fine with that. You know, like, I don't really, I mean, so, like, I think my wife is like a long suffering, but she knows who she married, you know, but she doesn't get to enjoy like a luxurious, like a nice house and like going out to parties or whatever. Like, she's like, yeah, my husband, you know, tweets a lot and is very nerdy and writes books and like it's kind of, I mean, we go on walks, we try to have nice dinners now and then, but like I'm not, you know, like this super romantic. I would like to be, but you know, it's like I'm not that. Like I'm just, and I think if you find anybody who's kind of intense about something, like everything else in their life kind of like the rest of the knobs get turned down somewhat, and like it's not great, but like it is what it is. And I mean, ideally you don't hurt people, right? You don't like disappoint people, betray people. Like, you try and manage expectations correctly, and you know, show up when you can and all those things. But yeah, you know, no one is gonna expect, and again, I don't think that, like, if I were giving a speech to a bunch of kids or whatever, I wouldn't be like, you should be ambitious and you should like sacrifice family for, no, you shouldn't. It's just, there comes a point where I don't know if people have choices, you know. I mean people should try. Like, I will never enjoy using a calendar, you know. I will never enjoy accounting, and I have met people who enjoy using calendars and enjoy like managing money and enjoy like counting the details, making sure everything, like keeping a budget. They get off on it. They're like, ooh, it feels so good to have everything in order. I want nothing to do with it. And like, I can try to get better at it, but it's far better for me to like hire someone else or get someone else who likes to do that stuff to do it. And I think there's something of that essence here as well. Like,
yeah,
there's things that I'm good at that I enjoy doing. There's things that I don't enjoy doing. I don't believe in being like a dick or a diva about things that, like, you know, so like, do I enjoy doing the dishes? But I do I'm not gonna like, oh, I'm above doing the dishes. No, one of my favorite talking points is like, never be such a diva of a hero that you don't help the old lady find her frying pan. This is a direct reference to a Witcher side quest, if you played The Witcher. But it's like, sometimes you get these messianic types who feel that they're so important that they can't do little guy things. But like, the little guy, you know, like, so if you as a hero, you're like going to slay the dragon to protect the village, you should not piss on the village to slay the dragon. Because, you know, like, the village is the point, right? Like, don't think of yourself as superior to people and like above human stuff. But if you're bad at it, you're bad at it. You know, like, and don't like lie to yourself about it and try to represent yourself honestly. I don't know. It's messy.
It's very messy.
I think, I witnessed Cheryl Strayed on a podcast with Tim Ferriss, I think, and they were discussing how they handle like correspondence with fans and stuff. And both of them have like way more correspondence than I can imagine. But like, and they both struggle with it. You know, it's like you want to respond to everyone, but there comes a point where there's just so much and you just can't keep up with it. And what they came around to, it's the same thing that Neil Stephenson said. So Neil Stephenson has this blog post that's like, why I am a bad correspondent. And he said something like, I make just about enough money from my novels to make a living as a novelist, but not enough to like hire someone to help me with my correspondence. I get a lot of mail. If I were to try and reply to all my mail, that would be my full-time job. And I'm trying to be a good novelist. So forgive me for being a bad correspondent. I am trying to be a good novelist. Right. And, you know, I don't think that it's so I would not tolerate like sacrificing my family life, for example. Like, I don't want to grow old and be like, my wife and kids had to suffer so that I could do my work. No, I don't want to do that. Mm-hmm. I think that's one line for me I won't cross. But I think beyond that, like, some of my friends might tell you that, oh, you know, Visa's kind of like, it's funny that Visa talks about friendship all the time, but he doesn't really hang out. You know, like he hangs out a bit, but he's spacing out, he's thinking about other things. He's like not super present. I try to be more present. It's like I'm working on it, but like you know, it is what it is. Yeah.
But I think you're also talking about it in terms of the whole, right? Like within a collection of 20 people, not everyone's gonna be 7 across the board for all
of
these attributes. You need other people to compensate for your lack of friendliness, but then you bring something else to the table. I ask this question because it's something that like I struggle with daily, like this question of do I try to cultivate do I try to improve the areas where I'm weak, or like just double down on the areas where I have strengths? And I think I am coming around to the idea that there is to your point of like don't piss on the village. Like there's a baseline expectation around how you should behave for each of these axes or attributes. But then above that, like you can't spend all of your time and effort worrying about bringing everything up to an 8. It's like, no, I'm ambitious. Like that's my thing. But I think the challenge here, and to tie this into introspect, is like understanding what it is you're good at. Like I think there's a lot of people out there faking or kind of borrowing from like the idea of mimetics. Like I see this person. I see Elon over here. I want to be ambitious like that, but you just aren't, and you fail to like recognize that. So I think first and foremost, you have to be aware and try to cultivate like this authenticness, and from that stems that surfaces the things that are strengths, and then you double down on those. Is what I'm coming around to. Unproven.
Yeah. And this actually ties to scenes again, but also friend groups or whatever, which is like, one of Jane Jacobs' ideas, which seems a bit intensely phrased, but I think I've come around thinking it must be correct, is that all wealth is created from specialization and trade. Mm-hmm. And like, which is like, as a sentence, it's like intense, it's like succinct and punchy and like the very bold claim, like, what, really? And then you're like, I mean, with like import replacement, like you figure out how to do something, you do it really well. And like, so if you are the best baker in a village, then you just bake bread for everyone else and you trade that bread for, you know, like the blacksmith does your stuff for this, that like you just, it's when you have a group of 10 people and each person is excellent at one thing, then now you, as a group, you're excellent at 10 things, right? And that allows all of you to collectively punch above your weight. And one of the stories I like to tell is, I have a friend, Sam, and he is like a physical movement coach, like 7th. He's like excellent at, you tell him, oh, my shoulder hurts a certain way, he'll be like, oh, you got to do this exercise, and then you got to put a ball here and smash it, and like, it's your pain gone. And like, it somehow, he really does it. And he has dedicated years and years of his life to understanding muscle aches and pains, and he knows how to solve it. But like, you know, his business practice was like kind of, like he had very, very happy clients, but like a handful of them. And I'm like, holy shit, dude, like I can help you with that. Like I know people, right? Like so.
Right.
And so I introduced him to a whole bunch of my friends, and he helped like dozens and dozens of my friends, like with all their aches and pains. So like together we are able to, like he's good at helping people with pains. I'm good at introducing people to other people. And so together we get to help way more people than either of us could have done on our own.
Right.
And then you just kind of repeat this.
That is what a network or community is. Yeah. It's this like synergistic, symbiotic. Yeah.
And apparently that's basically the fundamental thing that explains why cities exist. Like you have clusters of specialists in every, like, you know, there's a finance guy, there's a blah, blah, blah. It's like, oh, it's trippy to meditate on. It's like, oh, shit. Like, yeah. And like, even having this call right now, yeah, it's like somebody specialized in understanding internet protocols and how to compress audio and how to like, and we don't need to worry about any of that. We just plug in, press play, you know, it's just awesome.
I love that. Awesome. Well, we're butting up against the half hour here. I always like to ask in closing, what's one question you would leave me and listeners with, whether to think about or act on?
So lately, the thing that I have been coming back to is this sense of, you know, a phrase that a friend said to me was, it's not the brain's job to want things. Like, so a lot of people struggle with, how do I figure out what I want? And, you know, and this is kind of the main, one of the main ideas in Introspect as well. But like, even having written the book about it, I reflect on it and I realize, I think I know it, but I don't even know it as well as I wish I knew it. But like so the pure question is basically like, how are you feeling, right? But like everyone says that to everyone all the time, like, how are you feeling? How's it going? Whatever, right? And we ask it with our heads and we tend to answer it with our heads. Oh yeah, I'm good, I'm fine. But like there is a felt sense in your body, right? That is, you know, like desire comes from the heart, or like impulse, energy, like, you know, excitement, like what do you want to do? How you like... It's all in the body and it's below the conscious mind. And yeah, so my question for readers or for viewers or people, listeners, right, is take some time to really like go on a slow walk with yourself, or like sit with a journal or whatever, and very slowly ask yourself how you're feeling. Because like, again, like in the pace of conversation, it's like, oh, I'm feeling good, I'm feeling whatever. Like, but when you slow down and you really feel it out, you can surprise yourself, I think. And the complementary thing that I'm thinking about as well, and I'm currently writing something about this right now, is how often what we think is tiredness, like, oh, I'm so tired, I'm tired, dude. Like, it's actually like emotional knottedness. It's like we have a bunch of conflicting interests and whatever. And what's mind-blowing for me is like, when you find a way to release that knot, it might be like you have two different things in tension. Like, I want to publish this thing, but I'm afraid what people think about it. And it's usually more complicated than that, but it's at least two things in conflict. When you resolve that conflict, so maybe you're afraid what people think about it, so you tell yourself, okay, I should talk to a friend about what I'm afraid of, and then like work through that, and then they can reassure me about what they think. And then you release that part. You then feel this expansion of energy and be like, oh shit, that feels so good. And then like, you feel more alert and more awake. And that's actually, so it turns out you weren't actually tired in like a physical fatigue sense. You were actually like emotionally knotted up, and like you're revving the gas and the brakes at the same time. So all of that is just kind of like details around the core question is really ask yourself how you're doing, how you're feeling, like what's going on, what am I tense about, what am I stiff about, like how, like what is the body feeling? You know, like, am I excited? Am I anxious? What am I worried about? What's going on? Yeah, like just investigate yourself, introspect. Yeah.
Yeah, I love that. And I think our default state nowadays, especially with I'm writing a piece on like, I think we're losing stillness and silence as a society, as humanity. Just kind of like my phone is in my pocket right now. I've got a watch on. I can open up my computer and have access to billions of people. We're losing this art of sitting down, being introspective, not talking, giving yourself a chance to really feel out what's going on. We're losing touch with ourselves. And I think that's ultimately the only way you find direction is through stillness and silence. But we mistakenly believe that it's through absent-minded movement, like just busyness.
Right.
And so I love that. Awesome. Nice. Well, we could talk for hours. Hopefully we will talk for more hours, but thank you so much for coming on. Looking forward to dropping this episode.
Thank you for having me.